Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. A quarter of the counties surveyed across the nation are now less affordable to buyers. The County Home Affordability Index is out this week from real estate tracking company Adam Data Solutions. It shows what percentage of average wages in a county it takes to purchase a median-priced home. For the first quarter of the year, low affordability has increased beyond historic benchmarks in 95 of 379 counties analyzed in the report, and that includes one of Hawaii's counties. Darren Blomquist is a senior VP at Adam Data Solutions, and he's on the line with us now. Aloha, good to talk to you.
Aloha, thanks for having me.
The national index for the first quarter is 103, and that's down from 119 this time last year. Why are we seeing the home affordability index worsen?
Yeah, that 103 was the lowest affordability index we've seen nationwide in 8 years. So this has been a downward trend for some time. And the lower that index, the worse the affordability, meaning less affordable to buy homes. And it's heading in that direction because we've seen the housing market is somewhat becoming a victim of its own success. Home prices have skyrocketed over the past few years since bottoming out in the first quarter of 2012. But we haven't really seen the economy catch up with the housing market. The housing market has been running red hot. The economy has been picking up, but not as quickly as many would have hoped, and not as quickly as housing prices. And so we're seeing this divergent trend nationwide over the past 5 years since home prices bottomed out in the first quarter of 2012. Those median home prices, and again, this is nationwide, have risen 57%, which is great for many people, including homeowners out there. But at the same time, average wages nationwide have only gone up 4% during that same time period. So if you're a first-time home buyer trying to buy a home, you're making average wages, it's becoming tougher and tougher because your wages are not keeping pace with those home prices.
Darren, even if you're not a first-time home buyer, the idea that an average wage earner would have to spend over 43% of his or her income seems to be almost unfathomable for a lot of people, and yet that's what's happening, as you report, in over a quarter of the county surveyed. How are people looking at that 43% number? Because there's some magic attached to that, isn't there?
There is. The 43% number sounds a little bit somewhat arbitrary, but it's an important number because it's what the federal government has basically said is the maximum amount that a borrower should be spending of his or her income on a home, and that's through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was established in the wake of the housing crisis to protect the housing market from the loose lending practices that we saw a decade ago that got us into trouble. And they've said what they call a qualified mortgage, which is one that can be backed by the federal government, by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or FHA, the maximum debt-to-income ratio is 43%, so the maximum amount of your debt, your debt to your income, can be, or your income to your debt, I should say, could be 43%. So, spending that percentage is really the maximum you can do if you're going to get one of those federally backed mortgages. And we're seeing an increasing number of counties, and as you said, it's up to 1 in 4 counties now that are above that 43% threshold in terms of affordability, meaning really if you're an average wage earner, you're probably out of luck in buying in those counties unless you figure out some way around that affordability hurdle. One of the things we're seeing as a side note is more what we call sharing buyers, where there's multiple people on the sales deed who are going in and buying together, and it may be parents with children or that sort of thing. We're seeing an increase in that, because lending is not loosening up. That certainly doesn't seem to be happening.
And maybe going, frankly, the other way. But just for comparative value quickly, what are some of those areas, the counties that you saw above the 43% threshold before we get to the ones, including one of ours, that's way above that?
Sure. We saw over 90 counties. Top of the list was Kings County, New York, which is Brooklyn, Santa Cruz County in California, Marin County also in California, in the Bay. Both of those are in the Bay Area. We have quite a few California counties in there and some New York counties, and of course Hawaii is mixed in there. Then you have Barnstable County in Massachusetts, which is Boston. Get into some Colorado counties. That's been an extremely hot market, especially in the Front Range around Denver there. And Austin actually shows up as well as one of those counties that's above the 43% threshold.
Okay, I want to just stop you there in the interest of time because we only have a couple more minutes. But we're talking over 43%. But now when you look at those counties, including Maui County, where you would have to spend over 100% of average wages to be able to buy a home. A lot of people are wondering, how on earth could you have a place where you could be spending over 100% of average wages? And in Maui County, for example, you'd have to be spending 100.2%. Kings County, that you mentioned before, New York, Brooklyn, 121.4%. How do you get to that point with average wage, or is this simply just proof that an average person can't buy a home there?
It really, I mean, that's really what it is. It's absurd, you know, that obviously nobody can spend more than their wages to buy a home. And so those people are definitely locked out of those markets who are making the average wages. And the common theme with many of those markets, including Maui, is that you do have folks coming in. These are markets that attract a lot of outside buyers, not just people who live there. And those outside buyers often are not as constrained by the local income, so they can come in and afford to buy those higher prices, and they're creating demand. But of course, it can be at the expense of the folks who live there.
Very briefly, as you look forward now into the rest of the year, do we expect to see this accelerate?
Yes, and the thing that's accelerating it is rising interest rates. One of the reasons we saw this affordability, in addition to home prices continuing to go up, interest rates went up over the last year, and we expect that to continue, which will make the affordability situation tougher.
As well, we know here. Thanks very much for the context. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Darren Blomquist is Senior Vice President at Adam Data Solutions. It compiled the report on county housing prices, and you can find a link to it on our website and Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, inside the Myanmar Marionette Theater. But first, your quiz.
Well, tomorrow is April Fool's Day. So with that in mind, today's backyard quiz centers on one of Hawaii's most legendary pranksters. That prankster was a prince of Maui, the son of Maui King's Kaka'alaneo. The prince was renowned across the island for his incessant mischief, much to his father's dismay. Legend has it that the prince finally went too far when he uprooted all of the breadfruit trees on Maui. His father, the king, was so enraged that he banished his son to the haunted side of Lanai. It was believed residents of Maui had that the neighboring islands was haunted with ghosts, goblins, and man-eating spirits. Being exiled to Lanai was seen as a death sentence, but our prankster prevailed and became an unlikely hero. Today, we're looking for his name, and as you're listening to the rebroadcast of the conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
In ancient Myanmar, once known as Burma, puppets had a freedom that the population did not. For centuries, they fulfilled a function we might associate with popular media, given license by the country's monarchs to speak truth to power. It's a tradition that was suppressed for more than a century, but it's one that's being revived today with contemporary subject matter. Ma Ma Nang is the founder and managing director of the Myanmar Marionette Theater, which is performing this weekend at UH Manoa. We spoke with her yesterday.
Myanmar puppetry is in the past popular entertainment for the Myanmar kings and queens. But it was not only for entertainment, but also highly esteemed by all classes. Myanmar mariners enjoyed the rare and powerful privilege of being speakers of both king and man. Mariners were a means of making people aware of current events, a medium for educating the audience in history, literature and religion, and a display of lifestyle. You know, in the countryside, they were the medias when there were no newspapers.
Did they have a freedom to tell those stories that others did not?
Yes, they functioned as mouthpieces for the people in the disarray, tiny hands and state and social affairs, so that the freedom allowed the puppets to talk to the kings or court what others dare not see. So thus, a great many wrongs were righted and many lives saved through the speeches of the puppets.
Really, it really had a powerful social effect then.
Yes.
And how long did that tradition last?
It was 500 years ago, 11th century Pagan period. But the first record we have found in 15th century, that's the Ava era.
And it died down?
Yeah. In 1885, when our last king, Thibaw, was taken away, the craftsmen had lost their most important sponsor, the court, and there was no sponsor to hire their puppet show, and then they found themselves in a bad situation, and survival was very difficult. And later on, a little bit revived again, but cannot compete with other forms of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And then nowadays, it almost died out.
It's sad to see a tradition that valuable die out.
Yes, really.
Is that what motivated your generation of artists to revive it?
Yes, I launched the Myanmar Mariner Organization in 2014 to grow up the young qualified young generation who are responsible to take it over for this revival of this Myanmar puppetry. And we have been, so I'm the, as a director of MMO, Myanmar Mariner Organization, we have been organizing a number of workshops and exchange programs to grow up the young generations.
And young people back home are learning?
Yes, especially my students. I have to say, yeah, many young people, students in Mandalay and in Yangon also, they are really, they realize the value of this art, and then they are learning at me in my theater also in Mandalay. They are well-educated, even well-educated young generation. They are really, they love it. They love the tradition. In the olden days, the puppeteers are uneducated people, but nowadays they are even very well educated, who can speak other languages, Japanese, French, English, mm-hmm. but they have a great interest to keep this tradition going on.
And as the tradition becomes part of modern life, the subject matter has changed.
Yes, yes. Nowadays, it transformed. The way to perform is transformed, and we go to schools, many schools, and give the children the show that is to educate them, you know, for their health hygiene, or maybe child trafficking, to educate them for the awareness of child trafficking, human trafficking, and then also malaria, HIV, or to read. To, for example, today readers are the readers today are the leaders of tomorrow, something yeah. like that, like a story. We compose a story about 45 minutes, and then we now, last month, I think, there was a children literary festival in Manali, and then I also participated with the puppet. That is, the title is Today Readers Are Tomorrow Leaders. So mm-hmm. this, all the children, they enjoy very much. And we gave the message, very good message, to read to the children. It was successful. And it is a little bit difficult, hard to have a great success because we need the encouragement of our resident people and then also government. But not, maybe, yeah, we have to be patient.
Have to be patient
yes.
With society in general, or?
With the government, also with the society. You know, some rich people, they don't know how to value this ancient art. Mm-hmm. But only the foreign, we have to rely only on, mostly on the foreigners, tourists. The foreigners from all over the world, really, they love our Myanmar traditional puppet. They mm-hmm. really value it. But Myanmar people, they don't know the value of this, especially in our country, maybe, but in here, America, the Burmese people. Now, Burmese community in LA and in Las Vegas and San Francisco, they are also trying to invite us there. And then they realized, they came to know how to value this traditional art. But normally, Myanmar people, because this is a influence of other Western music, pop music, mm-hmm. and other stereo.
Sure. Yeah. So in a way, they've moved away from the past.
Yes.
And you see a great deal of value in bringing back the best of the past.
Yeah, I'm working hard, and Myanmar Marine Organization also, this is a group working hard for safeguarding this, our traditional puppetry.
Ma Ma Nang is the managing director, puppeteer, and founder of the Myanmar Marionette Theater, which will perform Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. in Orvis Auditorium on the UH Manoa campus.
Hawaii lawmakers are again considering a bill to bring voting by mail into reality. But as in other years, supporters fear that the cautious attitude might tank the bill in conference, and before we would ever have the chance to know whether voting by mail could shore up Hawaii's abysmal voting turnout. CivilBeat.org reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Hi there.
Happy Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
You too. Now, for years, we've heard that voting by mail would cost us less, and that, you know, we've got so many absentee ballots, a majority that are being cast every election anyway in the last couple of cycles. So
yeah.
What's really not to like about this bill once it gets to conference?
Well, something kept it from passing last year at this time, and I believe the year before as well. And the problem with conference committee, this is the last 2 weeks in April, right? This is the last part of the legislature before they pass all the final bills in May. And you just don't know what goes on. There's a lot of, well, there's a lot of horse trading happening. There's people bargaining for certain bills for certain amounts of money, and things just fall through the cracks. And the frustration for voters, for people paying attention, for advocacy groups, is you don't quite know what happens because it's behind closed doors for the most part. But here we go again. This bill has cleared all the hurdles pretty much and is almost certainly going to go to conference committee. And yeah, if it does pass, we could be seeing all mail-in balloting for all four counties by 2020, maybe even 2018 in the case of some counties that might move forward faster on this.
Which kind of brings us back to the question, why would lawmakers be so, you know, tentative in their support for something that seems to make it easier and that would right. cost taxpayers less, forgetting all the horse trading and all the rest of that, bargaining with about other bills, the fact that every election cycle, and even in yeah. between, we all talk about the abysmal voting turnout in Hawaii.
We're last, yeah. We are absolutely last. And they've looked at Colorado and Oregon and Washington, which has been have moved to this voting system. And in Washington, there's some indication numbers showing a 2-7% boost. But in answer to your question is why this might fail, it's possible that it might be about money. This is going to cost something to implement, and we're not quite sure on the figures, but at least $200,000 for the state, probably closer to $400,000 for Oahu, which is the population base. You got to factor in Hawaii County and Kauai. So there's a dollar figure that's going to be a factor. And as you know, money is, there's only so much of it there. And then there's some other things I got to get right. They have recently tweaked the legislation to make sure it's ADA compliant so that people with disabilities won't be discriminated against. And there are people that need help filling out a ballot. Maybe what you have to do is mail it to them electronically. So these are the kind of things that have to be factored in. You're also looking at setting up places of deposits, drop-off boxes, because, you know, there's always a gap with the postal period. You don't want your ballot to get in too late. So there's any number of hurdles. I will say this, League of Women Voters, Common Cause, they feel more hopeful than ever that this is going to be the year, but, you know, they're going to be, like me, down there during conference committee following to see whether this makes it out finally.
Exactly, and then we'll know what happens. Thanks so much. We'll all be watching as we have been watching now for quite a long time and wondering whether this is the year or not
yeah.
that voting by mail will pass. Thanks. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Bethann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today featuring reporter Chad Blair. And today being Friday, one of the things we like to do is take a look at what's being worked on in our news department. And to give us that overview, News Director Bill Dorman joins us now. Hi there.
Aloha, Bethann.
So what do we have coming up for next week? Rumblings of a Distant Prison?
Yeah, so this is a unique piece really coming next week. Most of our listeners probably know there are about 1,400 Hawaii residents currently incarcerated in Arizona. Most of them are Native Hawaiian. And that story has been out and around. The land on which they are being held is ancestral Native American land. And a while back, there was what organizers called an apology ceremony, that lands of one indigenous people were being used to confine those of another. Sonny Gannadin is a local attorney, does lots of human rights work here, also does some freelance writing. He was invited to that ceremony, and we sent him along with an audio deck, actually. And he's been working for several months now on putting together a piece about that. And about the ceremony itself was not recorded, but he had a lot of conversations with folks involved and a lot of sound around that event. And that's going to be an interesting piece coming out next week.
Something that we clearly haven't heard before.
No, exactly.
Probably ever.
No, exactly. This was a unique ceremony and event and the beginning of a relationship, really, on, again, indigenous people to indigenous people under the banner of shared incarceration.
And moving from that to what we might see next week in arts and culture.
Yeah, so the Honolulu Biennial, I know I keep talking about this, but
because there's lots of stuff to talk
there
about.
There is lots of stuff to see. Again, all around town if you happen to be in Honolulu. And if you're out on the neighbor islands, this is it could be worth a visit. A lot of cases just walking around with intention in certain areas. Noe Tanigawa is going to continue to be a guide this coming week. There's a floating stone cloud at the Foster Botanical Gardens, 21-foot wall that's got a great backstory at SALT. And also on top of all of that, there's a new gallery on Nu'uanu. So you can get some ideas from Noe about looking around with a new perspective.
Well, you're renewing yourself by hearing about arts and culture and hopefully enjoying it, too. We have energy also on the docket next week.
Yeah, and a different look at biofuels next week. Senate Committee on Transportation and Energy going to have informational briefing on biofuels as an intersection between renewable energy and food production. You've got that tension between growing food crops, growing energy crops, and maybe a way strategically to put those together.
A lot of good stuff to look forward to coming through your speakers next week, courtesy of HPR's news department. Thanks, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. And now it's time for us to dig into the email bag and see what you've sent us in the last week or so. Now, after Monday's segment on Westpac's efforts to remove commercial fishing restrictions in Pacific Marine National Monuments, Valerie Moore commented on Facebook, 75% of Pacific EEZ isn't enough. Fisheries greed is endless, and there is zero understanding of replenishing, sustainability, and protection of our waters. So frustrating.
After Monday's story on the legislature's exploring a surcharge on sugary beverages, Robert B. commented on Facebook, any opportunity to reach into a citizen pocket and take more money. Children are just the excuse. Roy Chang said simply, another money grab.
Following Wednesday's story on county health rankings, the organizers of Maui's Wahine Week tweeted, super interesting comparison and analysis on Maui County's health status as a community.
Thanks for your letters. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
This week, Oahu Republicans elected a new chair. His election comes in the aftermath of contentious talk and a party split over the departure of Beth Fukumoto. Earlier today, I talked with new Oahu GOP chair Brett Kolbas about how he takes up the business of building his party.
Very important that we start afresh with our Republican Party and actually start talking as opposed to being silent.
So what does that mean to start afresh as the Republican Party and really talk about some of these issues? A lot of people would say, haven't we been talking about these issues already?
Well, we have been talking about the issues, but you haven't heard a lot from Republicans, at least not from the party. I want us to be out there espousing our beliefs and our principles and our policies and give the community of Oahu a definite contrast to what they get from the other side of the aisle. They have all the failed policies, and so all the arguments are with us, and we just got to make that case of why voting Republican will be better for the individual and better for the family. When you get down to the nuts and bolts of it, you know, we only have a select group of individuals that are participating in the party, and those are the people are in a lot of the leadership positions at the state level. At the county level, we got about 36 or so districts. My count might be off a little bit, but each of the districts have at least four individual precincts part of that. And we don't have any precinct presidents, or very few, less than 20% of our precinct leadership, the real on-the-ground grassroots, the ones that are going door-to-door in their neighborhoods, talking up Republican values and principles and whatnot, are not there. So the people are only getting a top-down view of what the party should be doing. And I think we've lost our way in a little bit, and we need to get back to our grassroots and our base of support.
That top-down view includes a lot of a divisiveness within the party that people are perceiving. Even what we heard Cynthia Thielen say regarding Beth Fukumoto when she said that true Republican leaders don't promote a more narrow version of the original Republican Party as fundamentalists or practitioners of a me-first attitude and a my-way-or-the-highway mentality. Does that describe the party you know?
That does not describe the party I know, and you're going to have to really drill down with Cynthia about her comments. But that is not the party I see. I see a party of hardworking men and women that are struggling here in Hawaii day to day to make ends meet, to support their families, against the crushing laws and regulations that our elected officials are putting down on us. So I want them to be able to have a voice, and that voice starts with having a strong Republican base structure ready to go, that when they find a candidate in their districts that they like that's Republican, all that groundwork is ready for that candidate so that he or she is not trying to establish a startup team, followers, and all that stuff. It's already there, and they can hit the ground running once that candidate is identified.
You've made the point that you're looking at this from a grassroots position upward, not necessarily top down with the elected officials that many of us may see and hear in media. Nevertheless, watching what has happened with the Republican Party over many recent years and watching the winnowing down of Republicans in the legislature is what a lot of people remember and are carrying forward with them. How can you begin to bring this Republican Party to a place where there could be some substantive dialogue and where there would be a situation that many politicos have said in past, if we had a robust Republican Party, that would also bring out the best in the Democratic Party?
That's probably long down the road. I'm focusing on what I can do now. We got to get Republicans in office in order to be able to get that dialogue going.
Knowing if that's the long view, and that's always been the long view, and in some ways we've seen the failure of that long view, how do you believe you can change the way in which Republicans go forward to be able to get to that point eventually?
I want to be able to message Republican values and ideas. Once we do that, I think, like many people think, people will come out and run as Republicans for office. What you've seen over in the past few years is, the party has taken, at least the state party has taken on a lot of responsibilities that should have been with the county parties and the county level. And the county level needs to be where all the grassroots action is. When the state got involved with organizing the districts and precincts, it all became lip service to the grassroots, because they were never given the tools they needed. They were never given direction on how to do it. A lot of district chairs may have gotten into position thinking they were going to do well, but got stymied by the lack of support from the state level. That disenfranchised them, that they weren't ever going to be able to do what they needed to do. I think there's a lot of great Republicans out there that are ready to come forward and start working to help make our party great again, because I hope to bring a breath of fresh air and some principles and values that we can message on 365 days a year, first 2 years in the 2 year election cycle, so that people know where we stand.
How do you look at bringing the party together when we've seen such divisiveness?
If you have people sit down all together, you'll find out a majority of those people all have the same goal in mind. It's the way forward and how to achieve that goal, that people have different things that they would like to do. We got to just be mindful of some of the hyperbole that's going on out there.
Including from say, the Republican Assembly and a lot of the vitriol that's being spewed from them?
Absolutely. You know, everybody has the same goal. We want to get Republicans in office and change the way this state is heading, in direct direction it's heading. You know, we might not agree on the Hawaii Republican Assembly's message on everything, but a lot of their facts are correct. We might not agree on the party not speaking out on issues or doing some of the core stuff, but their goals are the same. It's just a different philosophy on how to accomplish them. And the same thing with the legislators. You know, we got to be able to understand where the legislators are coming from. They got a whole different mindset of what they have to do, especially in the minority. You know, there's a lot of things that we got to understand that they got to do. But the hyperbole is on all sides. It's not just one-sided. Everybody has it. It's just a matter of who is the loudest and is getting heard.
Well, I want to thank you for the time today.
Well, thank you.
We'll be listening.
All righty.
Brett Kolbus is the new Honolulu chair of the Republican Party of Hawaii.
Aloha, I'm Tim Vandeveer from the Democratic Party of Hawaii, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering a historic Hawaiian prankster in honor of April Fool's Day tomorrow. Our mischief maker was a son of Maui King Kaka'alaneo, and after pulling one too many tricks, this prince was banished across the channel waters to Lanai. At the time, this was seen as a death sentence. Lanai was uninhabited and believed to be ruled by demonic spirits that would kill any humans who set foot on their island. Different tales exist for how the exiled prince survived and drove the spirits off Lanai. One says he set their house on fire while they slept, forcing them into the ocean, where he killed them. Another story says the prince built many hiding places across the island, and the spirits died of exhaustion, chasing him every night. Whatever the method, when the king back on Maui saw a fire burning on the summit of Lanai Hale, he knew that his son Kauliuʻau had defeated the spirits. He promptly sent a canoe to bring him home for a hero's welcome. That's today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
But, you know, we had a winner on that one. We didn't think that there might be folks who would know that, but in fact, two people did. But Uwe Good was first and phoned in from Maui and will be receiving the prize. I'm sorry, she's in Honolulu, but originally is from Maui. That's it? Okay, glad we got the story straight.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the new play, Sweat, looks at a factory town where jobs are leaving and racial tension is on the rise. And it's got a lot to tell us about the ascent of Donald Trump.
These were middle-aged white men. They arrive at their factory one day, and they're told basically they don't have jobs.
Playwright Lynn Nottage of Sweat, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
Hawaii's only all-girl orchestra, the Priory Chamber Strings Orchestra, is back from a national competition last weekend, one that saw it earn 3 awards, including the Outstanding Orchestra Award and first place in the string orchestra category. We're going to hear some of the music from that competition as we ask the orchestra's director, Chad Uyahara, the secret to its success. What is your secret?
We're a small orchestra, and we come from a small school. So it's really important that everyone contribute. You know, with a small orchestra, you can't hide in the section.
Sure.
So everyone has to put out, and everyone has to give their best, and everyone has to know the music. So we really try to have individual responsibility and accountability for each student. And I think that's a big key to the success.
Sounds as if you might have turned your small size to your advantage.
Yeah, I think it's great for the students because we can focus a little bit more individually on them as opposed to if we were a big orchestra.
Mm-hmm. And you actually had to supplement your personnel with younger students, is that right?
Yeah, we have some pretty advanced middle school students, so we had one 7th grader and one 8th grader join us.
Well, Chad, let's hear a sample of one of your the pieces you played in the competition. This is, well, let's just play it, and I think people will recognize it. Well, actually, Chad, that probably wasn't one that people would recognize. What piece was that?
Actually, I think people might recognize it. That's from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Well, it had a pretty big orchestra sound. It sounded very, very full. Does it take a lot of time to get to that place?
Yeah, you know, students don't just come in playing with a big, strong tone. You really have to work at it, and you have to have them, you know, really listen to themselves and see if they're producing a big sound.
Well, you know, to get a big sound out of a stringed instrument, you have to sort of not be tentative in the way you play, right?
Right. There has to be a confidence. So it's not only, you know, knowing how to play your instrument and how to bring out the sound technically, but also, you know, just having that confidence to play out and to express yourself fully.
Just sort of knowing that you're going to, that it's going to work, right? And that it's going to work in an ensemble setting. What kind of practice time do you put in with these folks?
Well, our practices are before school. It's what we call zero period here at the Priory. So it's from 7 to 7:40 a.m. Monday through Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So for high schoolers, it can be a little rough in the beginning when it's so early in the morning. It's rough for me, in fact.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're troopers and they've been coming. So,
well, let's hear another quick sample, and this one even I will recognize, Chad. Well, that was, of course, the John Williams Star Wars theme. And one thing I noticed in that, Chad, was the way you actually have a lot of interaction of the different sections in the orchestra, don't you?
Yeah. John Williams is quite interactive and quite involved for all the sections. So it's really fun for them.
Do they practice separately? Or do you integrate their sound by having everybody playing at the same time?
You know, some days we'll have just one group, let's say the cellos, come in, just so that we can focus on, you know, cleaning up any problems that they may have.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we do that about twice a week, where just one group comes in. And then we, of course, have to bring it all together because everyone needs to see how their part fits with the other.
Sure, sure. Yeah. When do they get instrumentalists get their individual instruction?
Actually, we only about a quarter of the orchestra takes private lessons, so it's all done through the class.
Really?
And yeah, so that can be a challenge, but you know, we were able to do it, and
I'm amazed actually, Chad, that you would not need a fair amount of individual instruction on your instrument.
Yeah, well, again, you know, being the priory and the small school that it is, I can give the students a little bit more individual attention as opposed to if it were a big orchestra.
But they're still learning in group classes, yeah?
Right, right. It's not as if it were private instruction. Yeah.
Well, I think we might have time to hear one more quick sample if we've got one. Let's hear another taste. You know, Chad, each one of the music samples we played kind of shows off a different aspect of the orchestra, and this one being a kind of rhythmic strength. I would think that was part of your success in the competition.
Yeah, I think the group, we really know how to work together and listen to each other and play with each other, and they know how to follow the conductor as well. But then again, you know, that has to be all trained, and so we worked really hard to get to where we were, but I think the results were excellent.
One of the things that we hear a lot in terms of the benefits of music programs are the way studying music helps in other academic areas. Have you seen evidence of that in your students?
Yeah, I mean, with the orchestra students, a lot of them tend to be high-achieving students taking AP classes, honor classes, involved in student government. I don't think we always necessarily want to use music as a way to justify success in other subjects. But, you know, it does help with things like discipline, time management, listening to each other, listening in general, I think.
Yeah. Well, those skills have come in handy in a lot of areas.
Right, right.
Chad, thanks very much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Chad Uehara directs the Priory Chamber Strings Orchestra, as well as Intermediate and Beginners Orchestra at the school. Last Saturday, the Priory Chamber Strings Orchestra won 3 major awards at the World Strides Anaheim Heritage Music Festival. You can hear samples of those performances on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
The weekend is upon us, and as always, there are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Derek Malama, our colleague and Morning Edition host, joins us at this point in the show every day to look at events in our community that are going on under the radar. And, you know, families are always looking for things to do as a family, right?
Yeah, some good old-fashioned family fun is happening tomorrow on Kauai with games and entertainment from the 1800s and the good old 1900s. Remember the 1900s?
Very well, yes.
Yes. Yeah, me too. It's at the Grove Farm Museum in Lihue from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. There will be potato sack and egg and spoon races, plus pie eating contests. Also, a miniature horse petting zoo, puppet shows, a fortune teller, and more, and food booths. Proceeds benefit the nonprofit Waioli Mission House and Grove Farm Museums. Entry is just $2 per person, and it's in the Grove Farm Museum starting at 10 a.m. tomorrow on Kauai.
You could easily get the value of your entry fee back in the pie-eating contest.
Very easily.
If you're resourceful, yeah. And then here's a free musical event on Oahu.
Right, at Kaimuki High School tomorrow. The Hawaii Symphonic Band holds its spring concert at 7:30 in the high school's auditorium. The program features 10 pieces, including works by Rimsky-Korsakov, Vaughan Williams, and others. And it features 5 conductors, too, at this show. And it's free, but donations are five conductors.
I'm assuming they're not conducting all at the same time.
That would be a feat.
That would be a challenge for everyone concerned,
yes.
I would think. And then we have a performance on Hawaii Island, Derek.
Yeah, this is also happening tomorrow. The University of Hawaii Wind Ensemble is traveling to Hilo for a performance tomorrow. And we're talking 45 of the best wind and percussion players from the UH Manoa campus. The ensemble performs in concert at the Kamehameha School's Hawaii campus in Keaau at 4 p.m. And that's free. The performance will feature light overtures, several soloists and selections from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition.
Which, with 45 musicians, including wind and percussion players, is going to be a huge sound. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more about those events and others on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I woke up in an ambulance wearing a cheerleading outfit, which, if you're over 30 and it's not Halloween, just raises questions.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, a sword fight, amnesia, the rise of a hip-hop star, and the fall of the Berlin Wall. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 2 p.m. following This American Life.
And that's going to bring us to the end of this week, and we hope you'll plan to join us for next week right back here on The Conversation. On Monday, we'll be talking again with Hawaii Attorney General Douglas Chin.
And we'll meet the author of Feng Shui for Love and Money.
In the meantime, and well, whenever, we like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, we're at HI Conversation. You can get to me at BKOZHPR or find me on Instagram.
And if you missed any part of the conversation or any other show we air, you can always find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. Enjoy your weekend and come back to be with us on Monday for more of The Conversation.